If you enjoy this podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all future episodes. Also, check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/switchboxtv for video versions of this show, plus loads more videos covering sport, music, and lifestyle. That's youtube.com/switchboxtv. This episode was recorded in August 2020.
Switchbox. Oh, here we go.
Here he is.
Hey!
Hey!
All right!
How are you?
I'm all right, you know. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah,
looking all good. Gorgeous. Yeah, that's no problem.
All good, mate.
We look more like brothers than me and my brother.
I know.
I know. What's going on there? Hello, welcome to the Need to Know Music Show with me, Ronan McManus, here on Switchbox TV. And today I'm joined by one of Merseyside's finest singer-songwriters, incubator of Liverpool's embryonic musical talent, championer of the downtrodden, personal friend of my big brother, Elvis Costello, and the newly crowned king of lockdown, Mr. Ian Prowse. There you go, that was that for an intro.
What an intro. I'm glad I've just rushed in from the rain. That's why I look like a drowned rat. But it's all worth it for an intro like that, Ronan. Thank you very much.
No problem. Hey, how are you getting on, Prowse, anyway, mate? How have you been?
Ah, it's just weird, isn't it? And you know, I mean, I don't know what it is where you are, but Liverpool's pretty much returned to normal. It's kind of like its own little world anyway, Liverpool, isn't it? And people have just said, right, you know, we're going back to the pub. So the pubs are open and they're kind of rocking and people are going out. But there's no music around still. You know, that's the kind of key thing that's really missing from an ordinary life is that there's, you know, for a city like Liverpool, which is kind of...
Well, exactly. I was going to say it's kind of like, the you know, to be missing music at Liverpool is that you must not, it must be hard to recognise the place.
Yeah, well, you know, without music and football, it's a bit weird. You know, it feels like you're in the twilight zone, even though everybody's out in the streets. Then the city centre. I live here in the city centre, and it's more packed than it usually is. You know, people are coming out and spending their money and doing all of that. But it's without the music, it just feels odd. You know. But we've still got the politics.
Well, maybe my mate was out in London and he was saying it was dead. There was not a soul on the streets. It was like a zombie apocalypse movie or something, you know.
I know. We went to 2 weeks ago. On a Saturday night, we found ourselves in Sheffield. We'd been to visit some people, and Sheffield was just empty, completely dead. It was the exact opposite of where we'd just come from in Liverpool. Which had decided, Liverpool's party town, you see, as well. It's always a place whereby, no matter how bad things are, and they've been pretty bad in this place, you know, down the years, from time to time, people still go out and party. And there's a real essence of that going on. But I have heard that a lot of other places, it's as if the lockdown hasn't lifted yet, you know, so... Follow Liverpool, lead, and get out there.
So yeah, I've noticed. Well, I couldn't help but notice how lockdown was for you, musically speaking, because you switched to these incredibly. Of all the sort of live stream gigs that I saw online, I think yours was the most engaging. I think I don't know whether it was all thought through or whether it was kind of. Luck or what it was, but it worked really well with Melanie holding the camera and just taking care of business with the songs and the stories. And then, of course, the star of the show, Rosalita, your daughter, coming in, completely ruining your career because it's showing you up entirely.
I know.
I mean, they were successful shows. I mean, to be fair.
It was
brilliant. What's your take on them?
Yeah, it was... I'd come off the tour with your kid, you know, he was forced into making, you know, big, brave decisions about what to do because we were getting nothing off the authorities. And, you know, he just was looking after us all. And we said, you know, we'll reconvene. But at the moment, we just can't carry on like this. So I came home
with you know, boxes full of merch ready to sell, which, you know, couldn't do that because there was no shows. And then I had a solo show tour ready to booked in after the Elvis Costello tour, so that was gone. I mean, Monday Club at the Cavern, that went. Any like songwriting masterclasses, that went. So I just thought, what the hell am I gonna do? How am I gonna pay the rent? It was a panic. So and we had a brand new album, you know, to go with that tour. So I just thought, you know what? I'll go live online, Facebook, on Friday night, and just let people pick some songs. And if we get some people watching, put up a little link if they want to throw some money in or buy a t-shirt or the new album or whatever. And it just turned into something else completely. I met somebody in the street yesterday who said it was like a variety show. Do you know what I mean? Whereas a lot of artists would just put their phone down and sing into the phone, ours had all sorts going on. You know, by the end of it, we'd have like a questions and answers. We'd have our Rosie would sing a song. I would tell stories about, you know, when I'd met Shane McGowan or Bruce Springsteen, or, you know, our first met your kid, or playing on stage with Mick out the Clash, and all these stories that I've had amassed over the years. And then Melanie would do a little bit where she would point out the world's the biggest rotter that week. I won't say the word.
I'm going to say the word you chose is not rotter.
Yeah.
Begin with C. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, begin with C. And it was, you know, it was funny. So it was like an old style variety show almost. But the key to it was, I think, that made it work so beautifully was the audience, the interconnection between, you know, I was like would play songs, would learn some like rare covers and that. And people who came online, they would get their name read out. And if they'd had a particularly, you know, difficult time, we would talk to them straight down the camera and say, I hope you're getting through this. Because it was so unprecedented and weird, this, you know, disease spreading across the entire globe. And it was like something that all of us, me and the audience, could all like get together and just kind of give each other a big virtual cuddle. And it just got stronger and stronger and stronger. And it was a proper, real community. And it was like an honor to be part of. So partly it was by complete chance, because I was forced into that situation. But as it went along, I would spend the whole week preparing the show. So it never floundered. There was always some structure to what was going on. But it wasn't like really rigid. Anything might happen as well, you know.
And it did, generally.
it was the audience, you know. They were just beautiful. They were and they would respond to the music we were making as well, you know. That was still the central part of the whole thing, was the singing of the songs and you know.
But I think it's testament to the you've got this connection with your crowd where you seem to know everybody that's ever bought one of your records. Yeah. It's like, well, it seems like you've sort of not so much fans, it was like one big family. And I think the lockdown shows, those shows, and the way that you set them up with Mel, sort of, she used to read out messages from people and so what moderating that side of things. Yeah. What you drink, hashtag what you're drinking. And I don't know, I think it just, I think that sort of one big happy family thing, we just really suited the everything just came together. I think it was really good.
And it felt like that, you know. It did feel like that, and that's why I treated it with a lot of respect and prepared a proper show for the 17 weeks. You know, it was relentless, week after week after week. I didn't have much time to do anything else. But I've always been of the view, which is kind of anti what you might expect lead singers and songwriters to be like, that if somebody's going to spend their hard-earned time and money on either buying my music or coming to a show, then I'm going to always afford you the respect of doing it properly. And if you want to say hello to me or have a pint or whatever, then I'll bother me arse to learn your name, and I'll bother to, you know, we'll be mates if you like. You know, that's always been my attitude toward it, because it's an honor to sing to people. You know, and if they particularly find that some of your songs are particularly touching or relevant to their lives, then I you know, I've always thought that was a complete honor, and I don't ever take it for granted, and I certainly don't ever think that I'm, you know, God's gift because I can do it. I think it's music's much more communal than that.
I just wanted to go to sort of where it all started for you, really, because Ellesmere Port, yeah. Big Tranmere Rovers fan, as our family are all Tranmere Rovers fans. We first connected actually backstage. The first met you, I think, was one of Declan's shows, and yeah. we started to outdo each other with the most obscure Tranmere Rovers player we could find. Yeah. But it was
Rochdale away in '84. Bobby Frank's blue and white army went down 4-0, and you were like, "Yeah, but were you at Scunthorpe?" And I knew I had a kindred spirit then, you know.
And then we eventually got into music at some point. I don't know why, maybe not. What sort of feels like you've music sort of part of your soul? Was it always kind of part of what you did? Was it kind of a drive? Was it in the family? How did it all sort of start?
No, there's no musicians that I know in our family. There was no instruments lying around. Like, you know, our Rosie's got my instruments lying around and she's got a piano and all that. There was none of that in our family. We were just like any other, just really straightforward, like working class family, in that, you know, my mum would go to the shops and she'd buy, you know, all the groceries, and she'd always come back with a record. There's a record shop in every single town and village, wasn't there? So she'd come back with, and she bought a lot like soul records. So there was always music around, but it never struck me that I could possibly do it myself until, you know, basically the punk and the new wave movement. I got the aftershocks of that, and I wasn't quite old enough to get involved in it, but I felt like I was being remotely schooled by Joe Strummer, Paul Weller, Elvis Costello, Hugh Cornwell, you know, Debbie Harry, Chrissie Hynde, and that's how it felt for me. And who wouldn't be inspired by that outburst of music that happened between, you know, 1977 and 1980, 81, or whatever was going on, you know, post-punk and everything. And of course, coming from the Merseyside area, I've always been in and out of Liverpool my entire life. And Liverpool itself is just an inspiration, you know, because of the Beatles. But then you'd be walking around the street and you'd see Ian McCulloch and you think, Jesus, wow, you know, you can do this thing for real yourself. So that's when I was inspired. I was a year zero kid, 100% year zero kid. Still am.
So what sort of age were you when you started playing?
I was only, I didn't actually buy a guitar until I was 15 or 16. And I found out recently that Joe Strummer didn't actually start playing the guitar until he was 21, which is crazy when you consider...
He made up for lost time, didn't he, really?
When you consider the influence he went on to have, and still has, really. It's mad, and it doesn't matter, but the only thing that matters for me, and what I got off Paul Weller and Joe and Elvis and all that, was conviction. You know, that when you play music, you're not playing it just to be famous or make money or maybe get girls or boys or whatever it is. It's because you want to change the world a little bit, you know, and you're playing with conviction. And that's the fuel with which I got off them, and I still run to this day. Whenever I'm writing a new song or whatever music that I love, that's where it comes in. And it would later on in the 80s, I found and bonded with my ultimate conviction artist, which is Bruce Springsteen.
And I was going to mention Bruce because those of you who are paying attention may have noticed the name of your daughter Rosalita.
Yeah.
So it was a Bruce Springsteen obsession that I was going to touch a little bit later, but go for it now if you want to. I was going to say all the artists that you mentioned, all kind of, there's a social conscience, there's a message, that seems to be a running theme through a lot of those artists. And obviously Bruce is the sort of embodiment of all of that kind of approach. So that was obviously something that resonated with you.
It really is, yeah. I mean, we always had the Born to Run album in the house from when it had been released, you know, But it was like, it was weird, like back in the day, wasn't it? Because houses tended to have the big albums, like we had a copy of Saturday Night Fever, you know, they, or Rumours. And it was, that was kind of the way it was. And we always had Born to Run, and I liked it, you know, but I didn't absolutely go in at the deep end with it. And I think that was because of my probably 17-year-old prejudice against American rock music, you know. And it was only later on when he put out the Tunnel of Love album, and it just, it hit me like a, you know, a juggernaut with where he turned the attention to detail upon himself, you know, and the way that he wrote about, you know, being brokenhearted and a failed marriage was just knocked me for six. And it's still kind of my favourite album of his. And then I just, I expanded out through wherever, whatever he'd done before, and I totally got it then. And which led to my poor daughter being named after one of his songs.
Could have been worse. It could have been worse. Yeah, yeah.
So, but it, and later on, you know, with the same thread, Damien Dempsey, the great Irish singer, he's exactly the same. It's just conviction all the way along, you know. And I completely related to him. Honourably, we're really good friends, and I just totally get where he's coming from as a songwriter.
Well, that was one of the things I'd met Damien before. I'd done a gig with him actually years ago in the Hammersmith Palais, randomly enough. We'd done a gig together with Aslan. And so when I met you, and then when I heard you two were friends, I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What, you know, of course they are.
Well, it's sort of, well, I remember finding him and his music. Miles Hunt from The Wonder Stuff, we were on tour with them, and I think it's 2005, and we were getting on like a house on fire as well, and we're still really good friends to this day. And he said to me, there's a great singer that you'd love. And I don't know about you, but sometimes when people say singer-songwriter, I always think of kind of introspective, quiet, mumbly, and I it puts me off, you know. But he sent me Damien's Seize the Day album through the post, and I remember just putting it on, thinking, oh, I won't like this very much, and I was, by track two, I was in floods of tears, and it just again hit me bullseye, right where it counts, and I
think "Sing All Your Cares Away" is such a fantastic song. Just, I mean, that's. Oh, it's one of those songs. When I heard it first, I had to listen to it then 20 times in a row.
He's got so many brilliant songs, and he's written some brilliant ones of late as well. There's a song called Gaelic Island, which is fantastic. And we have a lot of things in common as well, because he's just from a council estate, you know, like I am. He's from outside the major city, so he's from a satellite area of Donaghmede. Is about the same distance as Ellesmere Port is into Liverpool. So we have that thing where we're inside and outside. And he likes a good time, likes a good out drink, and I like that myself. So, you know, it's, I think all of them, if I look at all of those artists as well, like Paul Weller and London, he's always had one foot in and one foot out, you know. And Joe Strummer was kind of not from London, but he wrote all those great songs about London. And Bruce Springsteen being the key one as well, isn't he? He's deeply industrial New Jersey, looking across the river to New York City. And I felt, again, that kinship, because Ellesmere Port so industrial. And that was the way we were brought up, looking across the river to this magnificent city of Liverpool. So all those resonances. They're like companions for you, aren't they, as you go through your life?
Switchbox. But when did you form the band? And then when did you get Palais together? And what was it like, sort of breaking through, getting on the Liverpool scene? I presume it was Liverpool you were playing in at first.
Well, I had a school band, you know, that we formed at school. Once I've been bitten by the bug. When I'm 15 or 16, you know, and I was trying to learn how to play. We had a mate in same class at school, and we had a band, and we were called When in Rome. And then we were trying to get somewhere around Ellesmere Port and playing in Liverpool and Chester.
And we got quite close. We got off the deal and it fell through. And we changed our name to Joseph Groom Towers, which is the name of three kind of rundown tower blocks in the middle of Ellesmere Port. We thought we were being ironic. And we almost got somewhere and we got on the chart show, the Channel 4 show. And then it fell apart. And I thought, right, I'm going to have to, this time I'm going to form a band and I'm going to make it undeniably good, write the best songs that I can. And I'm also going to widen my musical gene pool. I'm going to see if I can get a new Hammond organ player from Chester. And I held auditions in Liverpool and we based ourselves right in the middle of Liverpool. And the band was, we had management for the first time and I just tried to do everything right because I knew I was so committed to it. And it felt like death or glory to me because I just couldn't imagine myself having a job, you know, a 9-to-5 job in a factory like all of my mates and my mum and dad had. So I did everything as strongly as possibly as I could for Pelé. And it all came off because we got signed to Polydor M&G after about 2 years. And which again is just brilliant, isn't it? Because I'd spent a lot of years already trying to get somewhere. And then when we finally got signed, you know, it was a weird thing back in the day because if you weren't signed, you weren't in the music industry. You know, you almost didn't exist. It's like now anybody can put on their Facebook musician and they can actually be doing something else that earns the money for them. But back in the day, there was a threshold and you were either in or out. And once you got you then got a press office, you got a publishing deal, you got an agent, and all the things came with the major deal. And you were allowed inside. And I remember you're kind of allowed like music industry secrets as well. The first one being, I always remember being told that everybody knew we were recording Metropolis Studios in Chiswick, making the first Pelé album. And everybody in there knew that George Michael was gay. And we didn't know because why would we? You know, and they were, oh yeah, George is gay. He was like, oh, what? And you know, it's so awful now that he was. It was years ago.
Yeah.
He'd come out. I was like, so I went back home to Ellesmere Park going, George Michael's gay. It means sod all now. But back in the day, it was like you felt as though you had been given the keys to the secret musical kingdom. So that was, it was brilliant.
And must have been really exciting to have stepped into this world.
Yeah, it was, because you're in proper studios. Once we made the records, the first single we did went straight on the A-list on Radio 1, Raid the Palace. So hearing your record when you're in a chippy or you know, on the radio, wherever you are, was just cosmic. And you can't, you know, you've dreamt about this all your life. And then you're out on tour, constantly out on tour, Pelé. We just hit the road and we never stopped because I thought, I'm going to grab this chance with both hands. And then, of course, you get to meet a lot of other musicians that you've always loved because they're either going to the same pub, they're staying in the Columbia Hotel in London, or, you know, you're supporting them or whatever it was. So it was doing it for real was a brilliant experience. I loved it.
That excitement must have really bled into the shows because the stories you hear about the early Pelé shows, the gigs you did, and the famous story of the one with the singing brother. Was it at the Picket? Was it or something? You were in the upstairs room, and you nearly ended up in the downstairs room.
Because
the ceiling was just doing this.
It was true. Yeah, Raid the Palace had just come out, and the place was like sold out. And Pelé was just, you know, I'd count the songs in, and it would just be like, and we'd be going, dan, 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 little, and the crowd would just go crackers. They just go mad. And this one time in the famous old Picket venue in the city centre of Liverpool, the floor was bending about 3 feet. And the owners could see it downstairs. So they sent somebody up to stop the show. And we said, well, should we just play slow songs? So we started playing a couple of old slow B-sides and one waltz. And in the end, we said, we can't do this. So we just carried on and they just abandoned the show. You know, they said, it's too dangerous because the place was literally about to fall down. And it was, but that's what our shows were like. We were really, you know, put to the floor. We were giving it heart and soul at every single gig. And the music was kind of designed like that as well.
So it was something else, you know. Anybody who ever saw us in our pomp would tell you that it was exhilarating stuff. Yeah,
when you see the comments coming through on those live streams, and it's like people wearing that I was there with the badge, they got the sort of badge of honor of being there in those early shows, and it's something that it's a real thing to brag about among Pelé fans, you know, to being there.
It's that thing, isn't it? I keep seeing it in interviews I do where I keep getting being called the C word, cult. You know, with the difference being in that the sort of music I make is not even remotely difficult to access. You know, it's not like because cults are usually sort of, you know, maybe slightly cool and unusual and maybe difficult music, some sort of electronic, dark, whatever. I don't know. But for my music, it's just really straightforward. Songs, you know, in a kind of a classic, almost pop tradition in a way. And so, you know, the one thing that people say, oh, I can't believe you're not bigger. I don't even want to talk about that. I'll jump in the Mersey if I think about it. You know, failed attempts to become a bigger artist and be playing, you know, arenas just didn't work out that way.
So there's that kind of folk, there's kind of a folky edge to your songs in a way. There's a lot of stories. There's a lot of, I mean, the songwriting process for you, is it telling a story? Is it, or is that kind of, I know you've got a lot of those kind of songs where you're sort of writing about a situation or something specific, historical place and time. Is it something that you've designed on purpose, or that's just the way that things come to you?
Yeah, it's just the way that things come, and it again, you know, another C word, conviction. I have to be able to believe in whatever it is I'm singing about, whether it be a, you know, a broken heart or a historical figure that I feel a particular affinity with, or something that's happened to a friend, or whatever it is. It has to be filled with conviction and open and honest. And it's, you know, that's the thing that we all got, I guess, off the Clash, is that we're, you know, your guitar as a weapon to try and change the world a little bit, or tell the world a little bit about whatever it is that you want to say. And it's, you know, it's a Bob Dylan thing as well, isn't it? You know, this is your unique perspective of the world around you, and people either buy into that or they don't, you know. And that's what it is. You know this as a songwriter yourself. This is just you, isn't it? And you present it, and you hope that it resonates with other people. That's the whole thing. But musically, the Irish thing, the Celtic soul thing, is really the fault of the Waterboys Fisherman's Blues album. And when I formed Pelé, I wanted them to be a slightly kind of poppier version of that. Celtic soul, Irish folk music, never English folk music, for me personally. Do you know the way, say if you listen to a lot of the bands that were around at the same time, had like an English folk with a rock thing, like, you know, say like the Levellers thing, and say some of the melodies they would use. I was talking about this yesterday with my producer, Tony Kylie, and that was never ever something that we never went to that sort of thing. It was always a specifically Celtic thing. That we did, and I remember seeing the Waterboys at the Royal Court here in Liverpool, and they had about an 8-9 piece band, and it was a collision of the rock and roll band and the traditional players that he had along with him at that time, and the show was just magnificent, and it didn't last very long, you know. They never held it together very long, but that was my template for Pelé, and when we do our big Christmas show every year, that's still what's going on in my mind, that presentation of those two things.
Well, I'll be there this year. I've got my ticket already, so I'll be coming up for that one, the Christmas one. So I'm not going to miss out. Yeah. So I wanted to ask a bit about some specific songs. And I know that Does the Train Stop Merseyside is a big song, that, and a brilliant version that you and Damien Dempsey did together. I saw that. It was just, he'd have stayed over your house, didn't he, after a session or something, and he recorded it the next day. But yeah. That's a song that I think it's fair to say it's been a standout song for you guys.
Yeah, it was kind of, you know, it was the thing that turned it all around for me as well, without a shadow of a doubt. You know, we'd had Pele, and the industry kind of considers that you've had a bite of the cherry then, you know, so it's even harder to go back and get another go around the track. And for the first, six, 7 years, we couldn't get arrested when I formed Amsterdam, which was basically just a continuation for Pele, another vehicle for my songs, but we just couldn't get anywhere. And it was only when I wrote Does This Train Stop on Merseyside, and John Peel had been sent it, and he started to play it, and he had a really emotional reaction every time he played it on the show, because it's, you know, it's kind of, it's shot through with melancholy, the song, I suppose. And he would we would start crying on air, and that kind of opened up the gates again, and I got another deal. I got a big indie deal, and we managed to get our records back out there and in the shops, and I was back involved. And none of that would have happened if I hadn't wrote Does This Train Stop on Merseyside. So that kind of, I'm thankful to the song for that as much as anything else. You know, and then Christy Moore did a cover version of it, and it kind of entered in Ireland and folk clubs, the national repertoire of that. And it just, it's my most well-known song even now. And I've seen so many covers of it. And again, what an incredible honor to see people doing your song. It's absolutely lovely.
And I have to ask about Home, because that is, yes. We've talked about the Irish, side of the Irish, the traditional instrument side of things, fiddle part on that. I mean, it's just beautiful. I saw you playing with my brother just before this lockdown happened, and it was just the two of you, just a fiddle player and yourself, and it just worked so beautifully in that stripped down setting. And it's one of my standouts on the Story of Ian Prowse album. But tell us a little bit about that. I think that is a favourite, isn't it, amongst
the fans? It's probably my favourite song I've ever written, actually. And the reason for that would be the way that it came about was I was going to London, and you know when you come out at Euston, and it was kind of a warm day. I think it was in April or something like that. It was kind of a warm day. I thought, I don't want to go back down on the tube and it's going to be stuffy. I had my guitar with me. I walk into Soho, and I was nursing a freshly broken heart. I'd been dumped, and my heart was cleft in twain. And I was walking down past Tavistock Square and then down into Soho. You know that walk you can do. And I got to Russell Square, and I sat down on a bench there, and just got my guitar out and started fiddling around with it on a lovely, warm, sunny day. There was nobody else around. And I had this melody. And all of a sudden, all of the words just came out, and it was, it bypassed my brain, and it bypassed everything. It just went straight from me, you know, broken heart, out through the guitar. And it was just happened there and then on the spot. And it was like a kind of almost like cosmic, you know. And I knew it was going to be a strong song because it was so open and honest. And I went down to Soho Square, got my guitar out, finished it off, put the middle eight in, and it was done, you know. And I knew it was a strong one just because it captured exactly how I was feeling at that time. So, but it's probably my favorite as well. Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, it makes sense because it just kind of flows. Just flows.
And I think some songs you work on for a long time, and that one just came pouring out.
Switchbox. Spoke earlier on about the Damien Dempsey song, Sing All Your Cares Away, and how I had to listen to it 20 times, or Understanding Sadness was one of those songs that I was in the I just have a shower speaker, and I was in the shower, and I kind of had a playlist of your stuff going on, and it came on, and I was like, and of course you can't skip back when you're in the shower, so I was like, what's that song? And I had to go back, and it was one of those ones, and I think I must have spent about a week solid just playing it everywhere I went, every time that was it. It's just, and then it's one of those songs that I still go back to. In fact, I made a Spotify playlist called Understanding Sadness, where I just put it with all my other songs I love that are kind of sad as well. But can you tell me a bit about that song?
That was
you know, it came from exactly the same place as home. You know, that was the end of my first ever long-term relationship. And it was 1991, I think, just as we'd been signed. And we'd done the Fireworks album, which was like 12 Up and Atom songs, you know what I mean? It was like, which we played live. And then the second Pelé album, we got a little bit more expansive. And we you know, they weren't all just fast Up and Atom songs. There was some, it was kind of the first time I'd ever done any of my songs, which again, people know me for more emotional songs. And that was off that album, The Sport of Kings. And I'd been, again, dumped. And that was the key song for me and on that record, because it was just like cutting me veins and bleeding, you know, onto the tape when we were making the record, when I wrote the song. As it was just, you know, when you first have your heart broken for the first time, it's, you know, you just don't know what's happening, do you? And that was what I wrote Understanding Sadness about. And I tried to get it into a song. The depth of like it's almost like shock that you're going into, isn't it, when it first happens to you? And it's funny because it hurts like nothing's ever hurt, ever. And then it kind of fades away because it's just your feelings, you know.
I got a real bereavement vibe off it, to be fair. It was kind of that, because I'd lost my parents and stuff, and right. There was some part that just completely hit me, like as you described before, like Bruce Springsteen, like a juggernaut. And it just I got addicted to that song. I still am addicted to that song.
I, that's one of my favourites as well that I've ever written. Just because I know that they come from a certain place, and both Understanding Sadness and Home, if people, you know, I do get a lot of messages from people who like my music about those songs. And often they will be not from people who've had their heart broken in a relationship, but who've lost somebody, you know, like as you were saying there about bereavement. The song has meant a lot to them out of grief in that way. So it's not just, and I like that people aren't just going, it's a breakup song or whatever. It's actually, it's a human song. Loss, you know, it's about loss, because that's how it feels, you know. And they are, you know, similar emotions, both you know, bereavement and losing, you know, and having your heart broken. So it all comes in under the same umbrella. And if you can be a songwriter and write a song and kind of get how it is you're feeling out into that, then it's job done, you know. And and I'm made up that you like, you've picked those two particular songs because they're important songs for me as well, you know.
I definitely gravitate towards the more mournful songs. So that's something in that Celtic blood, I think, and the Irish blood.
I think so.
Switchbox. I want to talk about the new record, the story of Ian Prowse.
Yeah.
Putting that together, what was that like? It's kind of a best of, is that right?
Yeah, sort of. I knew that we were gonna get the Elvis Costello tour, which is just it was such a wonderful thing to happen. I've been doing this a long time, and you always wonder, you know, will I ever get, will something really, really lovely ever happen again in my career, you know? And then it did. There it was. And we're old friends anyway, and there's so many positive aspects of it, apart from the fact that I'm gonna go and play to all of these people, some of which will have heard of me but never investigated, some of which you'll never heard of me, and some of which might be fans, you know. And then at the end of every gig, I get to sit there and watch one of my favorite artists of all time, the roof off the place. So there could be nothing, you know, bad about that situation, and I loved it. But we also were conscious that it was a big opportunity, and we wanted to grasp that with both hands. So, and I'd signed to a great new little label in Soho called Kitchen Disco Records, and I said we should do a best of, really, for all the people who never heard of us, and bring together all aspects of my career with Pelé, Amsterdam. So
songs I put out under my own name. And we just did that and called it The Story of Ian Prowse, in honor of the story of The Clash, when they, you know, that album that they put out years and years ago. And that's how it panned out. And we did three albums in the last decade, from which we've got a lot of songs that have become, you know, really well known for, my fans do, like I Did It For Love and Desi Warren and Here I Lie. So we wanted to get them on an album with all of the other stuff as well. So and it turned out to be a really good decision, actually, because it's been a really good introduction. And with the, we also decided to embrace Spotify, which I wouldn't go on for a long time, and then it just felt like I was boycotting it all on my own, you know. And I was like King Canute, I couldn't hold back the waters of streaming. The earth dies streaming. So we thought this is going to work as well. So it was a good decision.
Yeah, it's a great album. It's a good front cover. Yeah, if you have to watch any of my live streams during lockdown, it's kind of Where's Waleed in the background somewhere. There's always kind of it's sort of cropped up somewhere in the back. So I'm sort of going, check this guy out, you know.
Yeah. I know I would send the link. Look at Ronan, but look what he's got in the background as well.
Exactly. I drew you in with my ploy, but
good man.
I did want to speak a bit more about the Elvis Costello tour. You've kind of covered a lot of it now, but what was that like getting on that stage? I saw you in Southampton. Was the one that I went down to. I tend to try and avoid the London ones because that's just too busy. I don't really get a chance to see anybody. We had a good chat backstage and everything, and it was kind of good. But I mean, you could tell you were on cloud nine at that gig, and you must have been amazing just stepping on the stage and doing that.
It was just, you know, it was a highlight of my life, never mind career, getting to do, you know, the most of the tour that we did. And it was, again, we grasped it with both hands. You know, we had a really strong and tight and killer set as we could manage in our half hour. And, you know, I couldn't tell you how generous that Elvis and his team were. You know, they would tweet what time we were on stage. They would put out our songs and say, you know, get in early and watch Ian if you don't know about him. And they really got the crowd ripped up. And most nights we walked out to pretty much a full theater, you know, so thousands of people were watching us. And then we'd finish the set and I'd say, come and have a chat, you know, come and buy me a brandy at the merchandise desk. And every night was just like, you know, a big queue of people would come and either saying one or two things. One was, where have you been my whole life? You know, it's just my sort of music. I've never heard of you. Or they'd be saying, I've been watching you my whole life. I'm not a newbie. You know, laying down their credentials the real Prowsey deal. So it was just, and then of course, as it wore on and on, this black cloud that had been on the horizon, but way in the distance, it just came forward really quickly. And when we got to Manchester, it became apparent that we weren't going to be able to dodge it any longer. And then after the Hammersmith Odeon, Elvis just said, you know, we'll have to stop it there, which was really, you know, it was heartbreaking, but it was totally understandable, obviously. And we just wanted to support whatever he was doing at that point. So, but you know what? We're all alive and well. We've lived through it, haven't we? And we fight on.
But it also means that there's unfinished business. So what you'll be sharing more than just a standard Prenton Park with him in the future. So
that's something that I would just absolutely love to do if it happens. Beautiful. If it doesn't, you know, I would totally understand. But if it does, I can assure you that I will leap at least 10 feet into the air as if I've just scored the final winner against United in the FA Cup
with a knockdown from Jim Steele.
In fact, the funny thing is that I've taken your kid twice to Prenton Park in the past few years to watch the Rovers because he loves Tranmere.
And we've been beaten both times. So
that's the last time he's going, then that's it.
No, I'm going to take him again. So we reverse the curse.
I wanted to quickly touch on the Monday Club at the Cavern, because we've had Tom Allcroft on here.
Lovely Tom.
And it's something that comes up time and time again with anyone that's in and around the Liverpool scene. Yeah. For those that don't know, the open mic night at the Cavern Pub on Matthew Street in Liverpool City Centre.
Yeah.
And it's originals only. Yeah. Isn't it? So the story is you were approached by the Cavern to do an open mic night, yeah?
Yeah, this is like 9 years ago now. So it's been going on for 9 years. And I've known John Keats, who runs the Cavern, for a very long time. And he'd asked me to, he said, would you do an open mic night? I went, just, no, I don't. The last thing I want to do is watch lads singing bloody Wonderwall, you know, again and again and again. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, do whatever you want with it. We've got this open slot, 6 weeks. You do whatever it is and we'll give that a shot. And I said, okay, let's give it a name. Let's give it an ethos. You can't do covers. And let's make it much, much more than just an open mic. So we invited poets. We had all the equipment set up for a band. So you can just stand, get up there. There's proper monitors on the stage. There's a proper PA. And I think the reason for that is because of the, you know, strictly no covers thing. And just down the years, you know, when I go down there on the Monday night and say, I'll see yourself there, you know, and I'll see people, other friends I haven't seen for a while. People come in and out of it. And we've had some amazing nights, you know, and I treat it with a lot of respect because it might be the first time that a young boy or young girl has ever played in front of an audience, and young bands come down, they learn their craft down there. You know, they play their three songs and they excitedly, assess what they've done. And they might get, somebody might come down from an agency or a record company to watch them or whatever. And we've had, you know, Dr. Robert from the Blow Monkeys has played down there, Lee Mavers out the Lars. We've had Hurricane Number One. We've had Brian from Frankie Goes Hollywood. We've had yourself. All sorts of people have come down, you know, Miles from the Wonder Stuff, Damien Dempsey, have all come and played. And so it's not just people who are starting off.
John Connors, when I was there, the actor.
Yeah,
I was there
one
time. John Connors.
John Connors, yeah, you know. And what a talented fella John is. And it's deeply inclusive. You know, you can get up and play if you're 85 or if you're young. It's anything goes as long as you play your own music.
The time before last when I was there, it was a night when there was about 35 people playing. I went on, I think, 8th or 9th, and I was the first person from the UK to get on the stage. It was an Argentinian, a Spaniard, a Russian or something. It was like crazy. Yeah. That was,
that was. Yeah, it was. As you've seen when you've been down, I'm just running around like a loony trying to keep the whole thing afloat. You know, right, you're on in a minute, and you're there, and keeping my eye what's going on the stage, organizing what's happening next. And I'm keeping the plate spinning, but I love it as well, you know. And of course, I'm always rotten drunk by the end of the evening. So, and I get a lot of like fans of my music come in as well, and they'll say, oh, will you do a song at the end? And I'm like, there's only one song of mine I can ever sing rotten drunk, and that's I Did It For Love, because there's two chords.
I was going to say, that's the one I've seen you do the most down there.
Yeah, that's the one. And that's only because it's so simple to play. But you know, I was speaking to the people from the Cavern recently, and you know, I'm very hopeful that we'll be back up and running before too long. You know, obviously in a safe manner, but it's been way too successful to end. So Monday Club will live on. Yeah.
Sure. We normally do a recommendation side of the we ask you for a recommendation of an artist for people to check out. Obviously, you're going to be uniquely like haunted by this because you've obviously seen so many new artists coming through Monday Club. But yeah. I feel like I want to give the Southbound Attic band a quick shout out on this section for their sausage song, which that we will put a link to, which is just it's an absolute staple now of the Monday Club, and people realise why when they listen to the song.
I honestly don't think that the two fellas out the Southbound Attic band would say, oh, no, you're not right there. But I honestly think the Monday Club wouldn't have lasted so long without those two fellas and that particular song, because it's just got a bit of everything going on, and it kind of, the whole night revolves around when they play that song. You know, it's the bit where everybody joins in and we come together.
You can always see it. You can see it with people who've been there before. When they get up, they nudge their friend and go, this is what I was telling you about.
This is the one. And the funny thing is that that's their great song, and it's the most famous song out of the Monday Club. But Barry Jones, the songwriter, he's written so many good songs, you know, and they play them every week as well.
So
that one great song leads you on to all of the other ones, in which are, you know, a lot of them are even better songs, so that's good. It's all good, and I can't wait to get back to it.
And would you have a quick recommendation of another artist, someone you think people should check out?
There's a great from the very beginning of Monday Club, there's a great duet, two girls called Me and Debo, who have a really unique sound and style of playing and delivery, and they've never been to Monday Club and not completely took the roof off. So I would, if you go onto YouTube or wherever and check them out, Me and Debo, they're absolutely wonderful.
But we're gonna have to wrap it up there.
Lovely, mate.
I would give your gig this Friday a play, but by the time this goes out, it will have been last Friday or something. Anyway, congratulations on a brilliant show last Friday. Which is actually
thank
this
you
Friday
very much.
For us.
Yeah.
So you're doing the encore live stream show, which is fantastic. And we want people to go and check you out, and all the story of Ian Prowse, and all the Pelé Amsterdam, and all the songs you've done in the past. Yeah. If you can get to check your socials for when the Monday Club's up and running, and get up there and get involved, because it is a uniquely rewarding experience. I think I've never felt an open mic quite like it. I feel like it's coming into a warm bath when I go up there and do that. Everyone's so
friendly.
I know,
friendly. It's lovely, isn't it? Welcoming. It's always good to see you there.
Well, fantastic. Listen, thanks for joining us, Ian, and good luck with everything. And well, hopefully I'll see you sooner rather than later.
Well, I'll see you at Wembley, hopefully, mate, when we try and get back up.